Oh, yes. Yes, the sounds of college football. The sounds we were starving for a year ago in that weird muted season. The sounds that are back, along with the sights and the smells of full-fledged college football returning, fingers crossed, in 2021. And this episode is going to be a celebration of all of that. All the stuff around the games that make this sport so unique and so special, so uniquely American. If you have any feel at all for the sport, I think you're going to have a blast. Probably no surprise, I had a great time putting it together. I met six new friends, aged 22 to 82. I got to reminisce with one very old friend whom I first met 35 years ago. Now look, it's a huge sport. There were, 1,000 worthy guests to help illustrate the unique passion surrounding this sport. We had to whittle that down. We chose just 7, but you're going to enjoy getting to know all of them. We've got some tremendous tailgating legends. Now, they wouldn't always share their recipes, but they shared lots of stories. We'll talk to the Ohio State sousaphone player who's going to dot the I at the Buckeyes home opener. He's waited a lifetime and then had to wait a whole extra year to live his dream. We'll talk to the leader of the 2021 Fab Four Horsemen, the tremendous drum majors of the mighty marching Wildcats of Bethune-Cookman University, a legendary band. We got the mascots covered. They're back this year, too. And you're going to hear exactly what it's like to run with Ralphie, the beloved buffalo in Boulder, and the hazard they don't warn you about beforehand. And what it was like to be the ultimate bad boy mascot in college football back in the day, back when there were no rules. We're going to start, though, with two very generous souls who are experts at throwing one hell of a party. Jane and Lance Foster are creators of the Zebra Tent, which is the centerpiece and the epicenter of tailgating, the Grove in Oxford, Mississippi, where socializing, eating and drinking before a football game are sacred rituals elevated to an art form. Well, the Grove is 10 precious acres of land in the heart of the Ole Miss campus with magnolia and elm and oak trees, and it comes alive on home football Saturdays with a barrage of tents and is probably the epicenter of tailgating. So, Jane and Lance Foster, take us through what makes the Grove such a special place and what sets it apart, Jane, from all the other spots in the tailgate landscape.
I like to describe it like this. The tailgating, other than the food, is for the ladies. The football game is for the men. And in the Grove, both of those things meet. You know, you've got your fashion, you've got your fancy, but you've got your rough and rowdy football. It is just such a combination of family time, girl time, guy time. It's just such a mix, and that's what makes it so different.
Yeah, it feels like a celebration, even though there's an important game that a lot of folks might be nervous about. It seems like they check their worries and cares about that and just kind of have a good time and learn to separate the party going from the serious business of the football game.
Right. It's just like, you just have to experience it. I've had people come in and writers have described it as like a wedding reception before the football game, because everything's so fun and fancy and the women are dressed so cute and the men really are enjoying the women. And the, you know, it's just such a good time to enjoy each other and have two good things, fun things going on that everybody enjoys.
Well, at the heart of all this with the tents in Ole Miss colors, red, white, and blue. There is this tent that is painted black and white in zebra stripes. So the decor under your tent has plenty of zebra stripes as well. So it stands out. But why zebra stripes in the middle of Oxford?
Well, I went to Mississippi State.
Say what?
I attended Mississippi State, and I'm from Starkville, Mississippi. So I had never been to the Grove when I met my husband, because when I was in college, we played each other in Jackson. It was such a rivalry. We played on neutral field. So when I got there, I was like, okay, I'm going to come, but I'm going to have this tent where everybody's welcome, and we're going to just paint it zebra stripe. And I had a little chip on my shoulder. And got there, loved it so much that now when you come to the zebra tent, it has red and blue stripes all over it too, with fins up and hotty-totty everywhere. So
She became a rebel.
Yeah.
She still got that bulldog in her because it's where she went to school, but she is a rebel.
You can love two schools. You can do it.
Uh-oh, that's you just upset Mississippi State fans, because it is a fierce rivalry down there. But I'll tell you what, I've been to both places. Tailgating, Ole Miss has a clear edge. There's no question about that.
It is a fabulous place.
Now, you mentioned it's like a wedding reception. I mean, food, drink, hospitality, the guest list, rank in order of importance those crucial components to a tailgate. What's first, second, third in that group?
Okay, we're going to go with the food as number one. Then we're going to go with the decorations as number two. Then we'll probably go with what you're going to wear, men and women, because the men look good too. You know, they're bow tied up, and
bow ties aren't as big as people make them out.
But everybody is really fresh and looks really nice for the football game. And then I would go number four with the party, the drinks, that kind of thing. So.
Well, some tailgates have special food. You know, it might be barbecue throughout the South. It might be couchon de lait at LSU or crawfish etouffee. It might be brats. They keep it pretty simple in the Midwest. You guys, I've seen your tent. You have something of everything under there. Well, why is it so important to be so comprehensive in the menu?
Well, one thing we do is every ball game is a different theme. So if we're playing LSU, then we have a lot of swamp food. We have corn dogs, number one, but we also have, you know, we have like fried fish. We have gumbo. Yeah.
Boiled shrimp, usually boil 200 to 300 pounds of shrimp.
I respect that you guys honor the opponent with the themes, though. You've had, if Texas comes in or another SEC team comes in, you're not just about Ole Miss. You're welcoming. Yeah. The hospitality is amazing. Talk about the different themes and how you come up with that.
Texas, of course, is like a Southwestern theme, and that's my favorite one. I mean, we pull out saddles. Sometimes we have little cutouts where people can have their face in a cowboy and a cowgirl. You know, we do all the hay bales, but we'll do like a Mexican fiesta bar. For that, when we did the Hawaiian thing, we played Alabama. Both quarterbacks were from Hawaii. It was extravagant. We had palm trees, we went and bought the fake palm trees.
We ordered, I think, 10,000 Lays.
And they lit up.
Yeah,
they lit
all up. Different type, and gave those away to everybody. I enjoyed when Cal came.
Yeah, that was fun.
We did surfing with the sharks was our theme. And we made it where, I mean, we had surfboards, all of that type of stuff in there. And that was a lot of fun.
A lot of tie-dye, groovy surfboard, surfing kind of. And we had a lot of fins up and shark things. And Lance said not to mention this because people don't like to, but I thought it was so cute. Our shark had this big mouth, and it, coming out of the mouth was this chewed up sign that said, "Ain't never lost a party."
You're still undefeated.
But Chris, back my favorite. When LSU came, I believe it would have been in 13.
Oh, yeah.
We had live fish. We had fish bowls with fish swimming around in dry ice. We did a piro, half a piro. We put dry ice behind it, and we had all the boiled shrimp in it. So it was like a cauldron.
Like a swamp.
With that, and it was the whole thing. We had magnolia leaves hanging from the
hanging moss.
And hanging moss and all that. That one was really very extravagant with what we did with that. That was a fun one.
I would imagine, even though it's Austin Peay, one of those opponents you talk about that doesn't have a lot of tradition with the Rebels, I would imagine the buildup, the anticipation, the excitement for this coming season at the Zebra Tent must be off the charts.
It is going to really be kind of a welcome home for us. It's going to be – to be really honest with you, as far as the tailgating goes, when it's a place like that, you have time to visit with your guests because it's not a mad, crazy crowd. You learn so much about their school and their traditions. And we really enjoy those games so much. We've made friends. People have sent us like concert tickets and paid our way to go see concerts. We've been paid. They paid our way to Mardi Gras with the hotel. People,
I went to the Masters.
Lance, someone came.
I got to spend a week over there.
Because they came to the Zebra Tent and were so impressed and had so much fun. So honestly, we can't wait to host those people. They seem to be really wild, really, they just love it so much.
Well, they've heard about it for so long. I mean, it's legendary. It's a tourist attraction on Saturday mornings because folks have heard about it, and the legend has spread, you know, all across the landscape. What I think is great about the Grove, and in particular your tent, is the hospitality, that you are welcoming to folks, because there's this idea that SEC football is so fierce that fans get to scuffling before, during, and after the game, and there's no way to break bread early because folks are just so mad at each other.
Right. And we, you know, we've had some things break out around the tent before.
They wouldn't dare inside the Zebra tent.
But I had to beat some young boys out of the tent with a metal chair one time till the police could get there. But
they actually watched her. They thought it was funny.
The police
security did.
Like, wait a minute. You had some visiting fans, some unruly young college students you had to hit with a chair?
I can't blame it all on the visitors. It was a combination, and it was younger college kids.
It was college kids.
And they got into a huge brawl, which just kept growing and growing. And then they just kind of, they fell over into the tent. They knocked the champagne fountain down. And all I could do was, I mean, I sent people to get the cops, but all I could do was fold that metal chair up and start swinging to get them back out of the tent.
Chris, I wasn't in the tent, so I got to hear her side of the story. And all of UPD, they come to our tent. They know us well. Just listen to them tell the story. And one guy's, I just crossed my arms, Lance. She had it handled.
It's beautiful. Don't mess with Jane in the Zebra tent. I'll tell you what, somebody should have spent a week in jail for knocking over the champagne fountain, because that is sacrilege. I know that mimosa fountain is a feature part of the beverage table back there. Someone dared knock that over. That they should get banned for life from the Grove.
We've had some crazy things happening there. Beautiful. We've had wedding proposals. You know, I mean, so many great things.
The most memorable moment to us of people coming in, we had 6 New York firemen reach out to us and ask if they could have a bachelor party in our tent. And you talk about fun, Chris.
Well, I'm imagining, Lance, I'm trying to imagine the collision of cultures, or let's say the meeting of cultures between New York City firemen and the genteel tailgate scene in the Zebraton. How did that go?
Well, they were so enamored with the women, and they were so funny. We planned it ahead of time, and it was just watching them watch the women. I mean, it was like they had never seen women before. I'm telling you, it was maybe like what you would expect if a man went to Hugh Hefner's house for the first time or something.
They were well behaved despite their enthusiasm.
Oh, they were.
Yes, they were great, and they wore Yankee pinstripe overalls with no shirts, and they were, you know, 24 to 27 years old, buff.
Could have been on a calendar.
Yeah. I mean they truly had an absolute blast.
I think they were thinking Mississippi and the overalls, and when they got there, they were like, I think we wore the wrong thing, you know.
A little underdressed for the Zebra tent, I think. Yeah,
but it was so much. They were cordial. I mean, they had great manners. I don't mean that they, but I just mean they were so taken with the women. They just could not. It was so much. They weren't accustomed to women dressing up like that for ball games. You know,
I find that incredibly easy to believe what you just said, but I'm glad they behaved themselves. I'm glad they had a great time, and they certainly left Oxford with some great memories to tell around the fire station back in New York City, I'm sure.
And we do a lot of Make-A-Wish kids, and we do Tim Tebow sends his Make-A-Wish kids every year. That is so rewarding. I mean, We've also done like we had three brothers who had a deal where they were going to all SEC schools.
Around the nation.
And the one brother died before they made it to the Grove. So the two brothers contacted us. And so we were able to get them on the field. We were able to get them tickets in the clubhouse, surprised them with it. So they came to the Zebra Tent and they had this last, you know, hurrah that they didn't get to have with the third brother. It was the most, I mean, I get a little teared up when I think about it because it was such an emotional time and they had no idea we had planned all this for them, you know.
That's a wonderful surprise. You guys have made great use of the platform you created. I know there are fundraising components to what you do with the Zebra Tent. So I applaud that. It's folks need to know that. It's a whole lot more than food, fancy dress, and drink before a game. I appreciate what you guys have done. It takes a team, though, right? There's no way. If folks were to see the spread of food and desserts, there's no way two humans can do that just in a few days. I know you're surrounded by folks who support you.
And you know, I get a lot of credit that I do not deserve. So if there's one statement I ever make that they often do cut out is we have a team that could plan an inauguration.
We get there at 5 o'clock on Saturday morning.
Yeah.
We're there Friday night, usually till about 9:30 or so. We get there at 5 o'clock Saturday morning, and that's when the decorations, everything is set up, the decorations are done. Then we leave, and about an hour later, we're back, and all the food is brought in. And then that's where the ladies get all the food styling.
It takes 2.5 hours to put out all the food and style it.
Now, College Game Day finally made it to the Grove to document that scene in 2014. It was my most enjoyable episode in 25 years of hosting the show. Katy Perry, as the guest picker, did it as well as anybody ever has. But Lance and Jane were also a part of that show. They were so hospitable, and they told me that 14 game day, that was kind of an equation changer for the Zebra Tent.
Chris, before 14 game day, on an SEC weekend, we would feed in the neighborhood of 500. After that, now it's anywhere from 1,200 to 1,700 that we feed. And we've counted before, we've have over 5,000 come through the tent, most SEC games, to look, take pictures, you know, grab a bite to eat.
I feel like I should apologize. ESPN's got a lot of money. Send us the bill for all the extra folks that have showed up since game day. That's pretty overwhelming. I hope you guys seem to be taking it in the right way. To think that this began with pickup trucks and station wagons driving to a stadium and dropping their tailgate and getting out a little beer and maybe some Tupperware full of food. Maybe eventually they began to grill in a hibachi, and it's grown into this. You guys have been at the top of the game for so long. What's left to do? What can the Zebra Tent possibly do next to top what you've done? Are the wheels turning?
Now they are. I never really thought about it. I mean, we just have, you know, we do the breast cancer awareness because we've had several of our members who are breast cancer survivors. We usually do another charity, we've done Palmer Home, we have kind of goals that we set with that. But for the most part, I don't ever want it to be something where it's not fun anymore. You know, we do try to do it cuter or better every time just because we like what we do, but I don't ever really want it to be competitive. And I don't ever want to feel like I have to outdo it every time.
I'd say the Fosters have it wired. I don't mean just party giving. I mean life. Throw yourself into it with passion and energy, but never take it so seriously that the fun is robbed. They're very modest in talking about how inclusive and hospitable they are. But I'm just going to tell you, everyone is welcome at the Zebra Tent. If you're in Oxford, you don't know a lot of people, you're new in town, you don't have a social clique to hang on to, you are welcome to visit the Zebra Tent on a football Saturday, along with fans from the other team and folks who've just made pilgrimages to Oxford to be a part of it. Very grateful for their time. Now, 2,000 miles away from Oxford, another tremendous tailgating scene at Washington Huskies games, or as they call it, sailgating, where folks take their boats. If they're lucky, they dock them in Union Bay, maybe drop anchor, take a raft in, and create a tremendous environment inside Husky Stadium. Jeannie Miles is the matriarch of that scene on the boat that her late husband Frank bought, the big dog. And Jeannie is filled with great stories and just as enthusiastic at age 82 about Husky sports as she was at age 8 when her dad first took her to games. Okay, Jeannie, describe what a college football Saturday aboard the big dog is like.
Well, we get up early at our house. The boat is docked at my home, but my son and daughter and their spouses own the boat. And we take our customers, we take friends and our family. And under normal circumstances with this particular boat, we can take 80 to 100 people. So we have someone greet them. They go down the hill and go to the dock we get going. We serve them coffee and a little continental breakfast kind of thing because we have to start out early. We're normally the first ones on the dock, and it's a treat for lots of the people. They've never been to a Husky game, let alone on by boat. So we beat the traffic. It's perfect. It's lots of fun, and everybody enjoys it immensely. It's a full day, however. You're committed when you're on that boat and you come back. You'll have to Uber home if you don't want to come back with us because we get there early and we stay late. So that's how it goes. And it's awesome. And I personally just love it.
I can tell it in your voice. So yeah. You're sailing along, you leave Mercer Island, you got the Cascade right. Mountains over to your right. There's Mount Rainier. The Olympic Mountains are across, and you make your way to Union Bay, and Husky right. Stadium is totally unique. Sits right there on the water. So then it's kind of you're not alone. You're surrounded by, I'm sure, plenty of friends and fellow boaters on those Saturdays.
Right. There's lots of boaters there. I don't know how many, but probably 100 and some, I would guess. And they raft out. We happen to be lucky to be the first ones on the dock, and people will drive over and meet us. And we then, before the game starts, we have the alumni band comes down and entertains our folks. They get on the back deck and they play a lot of the songs, the fight songs and the music, and everybody sings and carries on. And it's great fun. I absolutely love it. Somebody had invited me to do something this fall. And I said, I can't do that. I go to this Husky season. Win, lose, or draw. I just think it's a wonderful pastime on Saturday. I love the game. I understand the game. And I'm not one of these ladies that sits there and doesn't know what's going on. And we all just love it. The kids, one of my grandsons that lives next door, he came as an infant. And you know, we just don't leave anybody home. We all go. And it's just fun to be together, fun to be in that atmosphere, and blessed to be able to do that and share with other people.
I'm sure as much as you've appreciated it, the 2021 season is going to feel even more special because, like so many other traditions, it didn't exist last year. There were some very quiet Saturdays around stadiums. The games went on, but none of the surrounding things that make the sport so great. So how are you feeling for 2021, knowing that you didn't get a chance to do it last year?
Well, I'm really excited about the season, and I'm a little bit nervous. I just hope that this pandemic doesn't interfere with us again. I suppose we'll have to wear masks. I don't know that we'll have to find out if they limit the number of people. Every state's different. I fully intend to, that the kids bring, we bring the boat and we bring people with us. We probably won't bring as many people as my guests. And we have people that are timid about going out and going to the games, but I wouldn't miss it. I've had my vaccinations. I'm careful. I'll have all that disinfectant all over the boat. Hopefully we'll be just fine.
That's great. I think that it'll be celebratory all over the country, but especially
absolutely
a place like that.
Absolutely, it will be. And I can't wait for that.
The Husky fans are so loyal. So you were able to enjoy a national championship season there in 1991. I'm sure there were some big parties on the Big Dog. Yes. And then you had the opposite end of the spectrum. You had a season in 2008 where they didn't win a single game, but rain or shine, win or lose, you guys seemed to show up every Saturday.
Absolutely. I wouldn't miss it, because you don't just support the team and the, you know, the players and the athletic department when they win. You support them all the time. And I want them, they need to feel that and know that. And the boys that we've had given scholarships to, they know that and appreciate that too. One time I vividly remember, it was, I think we played the Cougars, and it was the last game of the season, and it snowed. And we were one of three boats on the dock, and didn't think about the dock being covered with ice when we departed to go to the game. I was in my ski outfit. I mean, it was just, it was so cold. And I think we had a 60-foot boat then. Oh my gosh. We had guests stay overnight with us, two other couples, and we even had ice on the inside of the windows. But we're tough Huskies.
I love
rain,
it.
Shine, sleet, storm, we're there. We always have the opponents on the boat. It doesn't, somebody's got to get.
Even the arch rivals?
Yes, they do come on the boat. I can't, I mean, they're dear friends. I can't not let them come. But I like it when we reign supreme and we win. I don't like to lose.
I'm sensing that. I'm sensing you're very competitive and you're passionate, and you want the Huskies to have a huge season.
Oh, we do. We really do. We have a new coach. Yep. We miss Coach Pete, but we have a nice new coach.
And, Jimmy Lake, yeah.
I hope that he does really, really well. He has all kinds of enthusiasm, and it's changed. I've watched how the game, how it's changed. We used to always beat Oregon. Now it's a challenge to beat Oregon. And I'm always eager for that game to come. I used to go to all those games down in Oregon, not anymore. They don't like us very much, but you know what? I don't like them very much. Anyway,
that's a rivalry that people outside the Northwest don't fully appreciate, how salty it gets between those two schools. You're right about that.
It does, and it does with WSU too, although it's more friendly. You have to say that.
One of the beautiful things about college football, the traditions that span generations, and the Miles family, you're about, what is it, four or five generations now that have been a part of this in support of the Huskies.
Okay, we're five generations, right? My husband went to school there, got a master's degree. My kids got master's degrees from there. And I'm 82. I've gone to those games since I was about eight. And my dad used to take me, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
I love the early lore before they actually built the docks. I guess Husky Stadium being built around the 1920s, people actually used to pull up these small boats, hide them in the grass, and then go to the games right before they had a fancy dock there.
Right. When I was a little girl, we didn't get to go by boat. But when I married Frank, you bet we went by boat. And I can't tell you how many. We've entertained probably thousands of people. And we have lots of tickets. And everybody has a good time. We even dance on the way home. And we have a disco ball. And we like to what's that song? We Are Family. Anyway, mm-hmm. We dance to that, and they can hear us all over the lake. You know, voices and noise carries over water nicely. So we'll celebrate. Believe me, it's fun. My grandsons will dance with grandma, and I go get them if they're not available, and they come and we. We dance, and all our friends on the back deck. It's fun. It's really, it's a good day. But I'll tell you, by the end of that day, and we go up to the house, I'm exhausted. I love seeing all the people. I love cheering at the game and being with everyone. And it's just probably one of my favorite things in my life, to be very honest with you, besides loving my family. But then I have them all with me when we do this. So it's pretty special.
I know you realize how lucky you are. I tell you, I feel the same way.
Blessed.
College football Saturday, it's exhilarating. I'm exhausted by the end of the day too. So
yeah,
there's no shame in giving everything you've got on a Saturday to entertain those folks. How great is Jeannie Miles? I mean, she's a treasure. I vow to get back there and tailgate once again on the boats at a Husky game. I had a great experience there after College game day one time in the past. Also vow, by the way, to get back to the Grove and the Zebra Tent. Now to the marching bands, the soundtrack of a college football game that wasn't there a year ago. No fight songs, no pageantry. And I've always had massive respect for bands, the energy, the commitment they put in, how competitive it is within a band and between bands. But my appreciation grew even deeper when they weren't there a year ago. I expect I might even get a little bit emotional calling a game when I hear one of those familiar fight songs belted out loudly. Now, the band at Bethune-Cookman is always near the top of the list, especially in the very competitive HBCU band division. Donna Wells has been a director of bands there since 97, since before the current band members were born. And he has built a wonderful legacy, a valuable, visible part of Bethune-Cookman's identity. Got a chance to talk to Kevin Goins, one of the senior drum majors at Bethune-Cookman, and you can hear in his voice how pumped up, how passionate he is about the coming season. Bethune-Cookman often mentioned as the top, or certainly one of the top elite HBCU bands. It's a small private school. The enrollment's under 3,000. The band is enormous. You got more than 300 folks on the field at once. That's a huge percentage of the student body. I mean, describe the Marching Wildcats, kind of the role they play in campus life at Bethune-Cookman.
Man, It's kind of weird because, like, coming from high school, people respected my high school band. I came from Carroll City, by the way,
Miami
Gardens. Yeah. Yes, sir. So people respected the band, but there was always like, yeah, you're the band, but you're not the football team, so on and so forth. That's almost flipped on its head here, and I'm not disrespecting the football team. I love those guys. My cousin's a football player, as a matter of fact, for Cookman. But yeah, it's like it's flipped on its head, and it's just mind-blowing because I never thought I would have seen any
wait so
of
it's,
that.
It's band up here, football team down there, if yes. You're being honest.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I'm like, wow, like I never would have thought, because you know the stereotypes and all that stuff, you know.
But you walk around now as a drum major, one of four drum majors for the coming season, so you are a leader in the band. You put in your time, you've been through a rigorous tryout process that we'll get to. What does that make you? One of the campus rock stars as one of the drum majors of the Marching Wildcats?
I wouldn't say all of that. I don't really feed into any of that, unfortunately, because you know, some people would be like, well, you do all this. I'm like, I don't even think about that. I just think about doing my job. I'm so laser focused on making sure that I can make the band staff's jobs easier.
For those people that have never seen it, and I would encourage you to go to YouTube and check out the Marching Wildcats, because there's unbelievable videos on there. What is a drum major's job on the field now at halftime?
So it all starts with attention, and we're the ones that blow the whistle and call attention. At that point, Mr. Wells' job is essentially over until it comes to him conducting the concert number. For the most part, the show is in our hands, so we give whistle commands pertaining to, you know, tempos for these various songs, because we're not playing everything at the same tempo, mind you. And, you know, starts with attention. Then we go on into our entrance typically, which if you've never seen a Bethune-Cookman drum major entrance, man, oh man.
Describe
every,
it.
Every year, every squad brings something different, and it's just so beautiful. But, you know, besides all of that,
well, you guys, part musical, it's part leadership. Like you said, you guys got the whistles, and it's also really athletic. It's really physical, because what you guys are doing is not just marching around in place. I mean, take folks through the sort of the athletic part of it.
So we spend almost the entire summer, just working on ourselves, working on our physical performance. But it's not always oriented towards or centered towards our physical prowess. It's also covering our leadership skills as well, because that's a huge aspect. You're coming in as at the earliest a sophomore in this leadership position, and you're basically leading 300 plus people of various classes and age groups and so on and so forth. So you have to be prepared for just about anything. Anything could really happen. There are good times and there are bad times throughout this band program, but we have to lead them in order to show the crowd that, you know, forget all of that. At the end of the day, we're marching Wildcats. It's just a matter of putting all that discipline and effort into a few condensed hours. And our product is just unmatched. It's beautiful.
Describe the drum major's uniform on game day. It's fancy.
Oh, yes. Man, beautiful uniforms. If I'm not mistaken, they were designed by Mr. Wells himself. And this isn't just for the drum major uniforms. This is across the entire band. Of course, you see like Bethune-Cookman University, but there are also little tidbits of when back when we were at college. So it pays homage to what came before us. It's just a beautiful thing to see when we're all walking up, just menacing. It just looks menacing. I get this from my grandfather because he's like, man, every time y'all get on that field, y'all look like an army. I love it.
Now, what is the anticipation like for 2021, given all that? How hyped are people to get back on the field and do what you came there to do?
Man, so just going back to 2020 for a second, last year was my first year as a drum major. And I was more than prepared after sacrificing a lot of my time just trying to get in the position that I'm in. So when I finally got here last year and turns out we're not having a season, it was a little bit of a bummer, not gonna lie. But in all honesty, it just made me a little more hungry for this year, this upcoming year, to do the best that I can.
Those are some very quiet Saturdays. You say a little bit of a bummer. I think you're underselling it. It was probably pretty devastating for folks not to be able to be out there.
Oh, yes. Oh, no. It definitely hurt. It definitely hurt. But, you know, minor setback for a major comeback, you know. And there's a lot of talk about us moving into the SWAC conference and what is BCU going to do in the SWAC. In all honesty, all those SWAC schools better be afraid because we're coming for them.
You're talking about the Marching Wildcats, not the football team?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, football team, too. We stand behind them. It's no divide there. Football team, band, all of that. We're coming for them.
I like it. I like the competitive nature.
Mr. Wells is always talking about performing like we're the best because that's what we are. And not trying to be boastful or have a cocky nature about it. But that all starts with the work. Just putting in that work so that the performance aspect becomes easy. You shouldn't be thinking about what move is next in the dance routine or where should I be marching next in the formation or anything like that when we're actually performing. At this point, it should be engraved into your mind well enough into the point where it's just second nature, you know? So when it comes to him saying, need to perform like we're the best or act like we're the best. And that goes where everything, just effort during practice, putting everything you have onto that field at each moment. Don't slack up at all so that when that performance comes, it's over for whoever band tries to step against us. Ever since I got here, like from the moment I stepped in the band room for the freshman meeting, I told them I wanted to be a horseman. So for me, making all those sacrifices that, as I alluded to before, working out, trying to gain weight, just doing stuff that was out of the realm of comfortability, mm-hmm. so that uncomfortable can become comfortable, and finally being in the position where I worked for, I prayed for, all of that. But when I got that call, man, I was jumping for joy. I was jumping for joy.
Yeah, it's a lifelong dream, right?
Yes.
Now you get to live it in 2021, finally.
Man, it's crazy because I was sitting over here thinking about how my grandfather and my mother attended to school. And and neither of them were in the band, but they knew how hard the band worked while they were here. And my grandfather used to take me to Cookman games every now and then because, you know, we stayed in Miami. And I remember just watching the drum majors and just being fascinated by them, never thinking that I would be in that position. But here I am. It's crazy how things go back around full circle. And then my grandfather is so proud. Just so proud.
All right. Take us through the emotions, the hype as it builds toward that showdown with FAMU and their famous band, which is an annual event, or homecoming night at Bethune-Cookman, which is another massive thing where you know all the alums who know their bands, they know their routines, they're all watching very carefully. What are the emotions like going into huge events like that?
Man, how exhilarating, man. How exhilarating, because it's just watching the alumni, and I think this goes for any band program, any school, just watching the alumni show support for you, and a lot of them have been in the same position as you, you know, going back, to see them come back and be like, hey, you're doing a good job, means that you're carrying on that legacy that begins back from Dr. Bethune. It's just, man, it's just a mind-blowing thing. So it goes back to even when I was talking about not disappointing Mr. Wells. Another factor of that is not disappointing the alumni either. I want to make sure that I'm doing the best with every march I step, with every dance move, with every entrance, you know?
You got to check out the videos of the Marching Wildcats and their drum majors on YouTube. They are amazing. Wishing Kevin the best for his senior season. Now, the numbers are down a bit in the band because of COVID, and Director Wells told me he's got his fingers crossed that despite a spike in cases down in Florida, it won't get so bad, and the band will be able to perform at football games all season long. He's just hopeful. Another band that I've always admired is the Ohio State Marching Band. I've seen firsthand their dedication, the practices, the rehearsals, musicians practicing on their own for the practices. Woody Hayes called them the best damn band in the land, and it stuck. My buddy Kirk Herbstreit has always told me that the band and the football team are held in equal esteem at Ohio State. At the top of the pecking order are the sousaphone players. Sousaphone's basically a tuba modified for marching. And the lead sousaphone player this year is Luke Eisler. And when the Buckeyes host the Oregon Ducks, Luke will finally live out a dream that he has worked for and waited for a long time. Help folks understand the feeling of what it's like to be a part of the Ohio State band, to have put in the commitment and earn your spot, and now you're marching around Ohio Stadium before a game, spelling out the word Ohio. Take us there.
I mean, it's a feeling unlike any other in the world. You put in all that effort, and here you are on game day. It's already 6 hours in. We show up 6 hours before kickoff. We go through morning rehearsal and do our skull session at St. John Arena, see everybody, see the football team, hear from Coach Day, march back over the stadium, march in on the ramp entrance, and you see the 100,000 people up above you, and the crowd isn't, there's nothing else like it, really. It's just you, all the screaming, everyone's clapping in sync with you, cheering you on, and it's just something that I've done it 21 times over the last 3 years. I've marched every home game. It's just, you don't really lose that magic to it. It's just like anything else. But of course, yeah, ramp's over, then you have to go do scripts. So you keep going, and a lot of pushing. It's just, you just kind of go on autopilot at one point. Don't tell my directors I said that, can't go on autopilot, but it's just, you get locked in and 3.5 minutes of pure focus, pure adrenaline, blasting away on the horn, and you get to your spot and you watch your friend live out their dream at the top of the eye. So it's just, that's something you don't get anywhere else. It's quite an opportunity.
That's well put. Watching your friend live out their dream means a fellow sousaphone player dotting the I. For those who don't know what we're talking about, I'd urge you to go to YouTube and watch. There are plenty of examples of Script Ohio being spelled out. Drum major leading the band around as they march and finally spell everything out. And finally, after the entire stadium has watched that group in that precise marching drill, one instrument and one musician separate from the group, all eyes on them. They are the sole focus of 100,000 people. High step out, take off the hat, and take a bow. Now, how much is it going to mean to have a chance to do that, the Oregon game this year in Columbus? Because in 2020, of course, bands couldn't perform. Fans were not able to watch this great tradition, this great ritual.
Yeah, and it's almost indescribable thinking forward. And I don't know, it's just one of those things with like a lot of last year, you learn about delayed gratification and never taking anything for granted. It's just when it comes to dotting the I, I guess it's something I was forced to wait for, but it's something that is meant to be waited for. You just have to put in the work each and every day and keep that positive outlook going forward. And I have done everything I can to stick around and make it happen for this fifth year. I graduated in May, but I am putting things on hold. I'm not moving for a job. I'm doing things on my term. And it's just something that you have to commit to. 6 of the 8 iDotters this year have all actually graduated from Ohio State at this point. So whether we're working full time or just putting our lives on hold, it's we're making this dream happen. And it's kind of hard to put into words. It's something that you've been working on since you were a little kid with ambitions, or say you didn't even have the ambitions, but it's just something you've learned to want more than anything. And we are all super excited, myself included. It's just,
I can hear it in your voice, Matt. I can hear it in your voice. And it says a lot that the sousaphone players came back after having graduated. You said put the life on hold to live out the dream. I mean, that tells folks everything they need to know about what it means to have those few seconds kind of cap a great career as a musician there. Now, I know there's an important person in your life who was looking forward to watching you do that last year when you were scheduled to do it, and she won't be able to watch this time. But tell us about what you expect your emotions will be, Luke, when you get your chance to go out and dot the I in a short time now.
It's really hard to put into words as well. It's just a lot of mixed emotions. I'm excited. I'm nervous. I don't want to screw it up. I want to do really well. And like you said, it's there's a lot of people in my life that this means a lot to, and myself, but especially my family. They've done nothing but support me unconditionally over these last few years, and they are all supportive for me taking the time to do this. And I think the Oregon game is just going to be a massive celebration for all of us. But yeah, one person I'll have in mind the whole way is definitely going to be my grandma. She's my biggest fan, absolutely. The most vocal supporter as well. She was, she told anyone and everyone she met about how her grandson was in the Ohio State marching band and I was going to dot the I. But from sports games growing up to band concerts as I got older, she and my grandpa, they lived a couple hours away in Canton, and I grew up in Columbus. So they always put in that effort. But when the band's, when we weren't able to do it last year, we were both really bummed, but we set our eyes on this coming season and looking forward to this day coming up. But, you know, sometimes stories don't always have a perfect ending like that. So, yeah, we lost her back in March. She passed away after a long, fierce, courageous fight with heart disease. So her unrelenting spirit, I know, will live on. And I, even though she won't be there physically with me, thankful to have had her in so many of my other life milestones. And I know she'll be right there with me in Ohio Stadium that day.
Well, that is beautifully put. My grandmother was very, very important in my life as well. Very influential, incredibly supportive. And I can understand a little bit about what you're feeling and what the emotions will be for you when you go out and honor her at that Oregon game. That's just tremendous. So, Luke, I learned about the challenge system of the Ohio State band researching this. Somebody has an off day on Saturdays. Someone else who plays their instrument goes out to practice on Monday and says, I want their slot. I'm going to take you down. And now you have to fight to keep your starting spot in effect. That's intense.
It is. It's something that keeps us. It sounds pretty cutthroat, but it is. It's for the greater good. You know, it's something that keeps us rotating and keeps us at the top of our game at all times. And that's what keeps us the best. You know, it's a necessary evil almost. But yeah, there's 12 people that march on Saturdays, but 14 that's in a row. So you have two people, but in the case of the sousaphones, we're sister rows and we're right next to each other. So technically four people looking at the 24 that marched, and they're always watching you throughout the week. Are you learning the drill to the show for the halftime show correctly? Is your fundamentals for the pregame looking out of whack, or do you seem like you're out of time? Are you long with your step size, and just all these different things? They pick you apart on the sideline while also working on stuff their own. And I mean, there are weeks I've had sinus infections and I'm on the verge of vertigo and barely able to stand up, horribly tired. And someone that was an alternate the next week is like, I'm going to take him down. And so I get my number called on that Monday and I have to run out to the field, still on antibiotics and trying to make the most of it and power through. And I mean, sometimes you just got to dig deep and play the mental game. And I had to lay the hammer down, I guess. I kept my spot. But it's just one of those things. You never know. People are always expecting your best. So.
And much like Michael Jordan, man, you had your flu game. You had to answer the bell.
Right, absolutely.
I like the sousaphone section swag. The whole band has swag. And to go by the best damn band in the land, TBDBITL, I guess Tibiddle for short. I mean, that's some swag right there. That's kind of cocky. Is the title deserved?
I don't know. Something that our director likes to say, there may be bigger bands than us that can play louder and better than us. There may be some bands that can march better than us, but we're the best at doing both and we're the best at what we do. So I stand by that. I'm going to leave it to the viewpoint of our staff and our band, but it's, I don't know. I respect anyone that does college marching band, and I love all the Big Ten bands, think that they all have something good to offer, but I don't know. There's just something unique about what we do. And I think I'm glad I'm on the one that people call the best. So.
Luke is a solid dude. He's a self-proclaimed band nerd, admires all the Big Ten bands, but you can just hear the pride in his voice being a part of Ohio State's. Now to the mascots. They were also missing last year, and they return in the live mascot division. Of course, Mike the Tiger at LSU. You get Bevo at Texas, Boomer and Sooner, the Ponies in Norman, the various birds, Auburn's War Eagle, swooping around above Jordan-Hare Stadium, the Air Force Falcon, all the dogs, most of them in the SEC, Smokey, and my favorite, Ugga, who'll be back spread-eagled in a bag of ice when the weather gets hot down there in Athens. But as a CU graduate, my favorite, hands down, is Ralphie the Buffalo.
Here comes Ralphie.
Ralphie's always a female buffalo. The males are kind of large, kind of hard to handle, and Ralphie 6 will debut for CU this season. Now, Sean Tufts ran out behind Ralphie for 3 seasons. He was a linebacker and a captain. Then he played 4 years with the Carolina Panthers before coming back to school in Boulder. And the story of how he became a guy who ran alongside Ralphie is pretty unique.
I was sitting in the stands, and I got the emails of, hey, you're in. And like this total euphoria kicked in, and I ran down to the rail. I said, I'm a student, I can run. And they were like, no, man, you're old. So I was like, I know that, but I'm also a student now. And they asked me if I still had the juice, if I still had a good 40 time, and I had to go prove it, and I had to get on with my merit. And yeah, it worked. They also saw some of the marketing appeal of like getting to brand the Ralphie program, showing what it looks like from different angles. And I was a part of that, which was pretty fun.
So Sean, describe what it's like to be part of a crew hanging onto a rope for dear life as an 1,100-pound rambunctious buffalo charges down the field, does a U-turn, and charges back.
Yeah, there's no on-the-job training that can prepare you for that moment. It's it's quite literally, you do a lot of work, you talk to a lot of people, you watch some film, and then at some point, someone hands you a rope, and they tie it to a buffalo, and then you get up and get going. It's, you know, a lot of people talk about like getting thrown in the deep end. I think we could rebrand that, getting handed a buffalo rope. There's nothing you can do to experience the prep to go through that event.
You practice, you train, but like most things, it's not quite like the real thing, right? With a crowd of 50,000, and she must feed off that, get a little more charged up. And the challenge really is when the lights are on and you're doing it for real.
Yeah. And, you know, the crowd does give a kind of a deafening component to it. It limits some communication. I think for some 18-year-olds that hadn't gone through that before, I think looking up and seeing all the smiling faces, yelling and screaming, I think it's a bit of a starstruck moment for a lot of people that haven't had that experience before. But yeah, nothing compares to that first 20 or 30 feet when she's running out and your hat's blowing off and you're running faster than you can humanly run because you've got something towing you down the field. That's a unique system overload that, you know, I don't think you really catch up on it until you're on the back stretch and you're finishing the run. Like just the effort and the momentum of what's happening. The funny part is when one thing they don't tell you when you're training Ralphie, and they purposely don't tell anyone this. So she wears a harness. It goes around her front, around her chest, around her side, and around her butt. So in your first run, and I ran loop, which is a heavy position, you stand in the back and you run with your heels down and you try to slow Ralphie with your body weight. But that rope runs right around her backside and it collects anything she drops off. So when you're running, you'll be running down the field and there's just little pivots of buffalo shit like popping off into your face and into your hat and on your shirt. They don't tell you that. That wasn't in the manual.
People have their favorite mascots and their favorite schools, but I think Ralphie has in universal appeal just because it's so unique. You ever get any comments from folks who found out you had done this or why you were doing this that had questions about her? Because she is a curiosity.
You know, we used to get a lot of competing sports program that had buffaloes for mascots, college, pro, and they were always trying to like figure out what made us tick. And it was always like, that's our thing. Like, we're not going to teach you how to do that. And we'd check in with them and see how they were doing. And they, you know, sometimes they'd pull like a 2-year-old male buffalo off a ranch somewhere and try to get some yokels to run with it. And that always ended poorly. Outside of that, I think there's just a general curiosity, right? Like we're a couple degrees away from, you know, farm to table is a term, but you never actually get to the farm, right? You never actually get to see it. So I think people are very curious around like, what is the temperament of a buffalo? You know, you see him in Yellowstone or you see him somewhere else. It's a unique animal. And, you know, we've got one that's, you know, not domesticated by any means, but she's approachable. We can interact with her. She goes to, you know, public events and licks gloves. She loves the taste of leather. So she'll lick your gloves, she'll lick your shoes, and she'll lick her tongue is like sandpaper. So she will lick the finish off your shoes if you show up with some nice, you know, wingtips or Allen Edmonds or something. People just aren't used to that. They want to know what makes a buffalo tick. And we got, you know, I got 2 years doing it and getting able to train her and be with her and have her train me was an honor.
You mentioned the training. The year before, this, I guess it was Ralphie Fye, that the 2008 in the spring game, which was her debut. Folks can see this on YouTube if you want to see her get away. And a Ralphie run that did not work out perfectly. She kind of got free completely from the handlers and kind of decided to do her own thing before they finally reined her in.
Not completely. We had one rope on her still, and that was our saving grace. When we run Ralphie, she's typically between 1,000 and 1,500 pounds. In the first year, this upcoming year, she's going to be about 400 to 500 pounds. That year, her first run, we put a game day, harness on her that wasn't sized right. So that was our mistake. And she stepped out of it. She stepped up over the line and shook loose of 4 of the 5 ropes. So we still had one that was around her head halter that we used to kind of anchor her down and get her back home safe. But that was some of the worst case scenario. How do you get the buffalo back? You know, she's trained to go to her trailer. She loves her trailer. It's where she gets fed. She, you know, she travels, she loves hanging out in there. And so once we can get her vision on the trailer, she'll know that's her home. You know, she likes being on Folsom Field, but I wouldn't say it's her top 10 favorite or, you know, her number one. She wants to be in the trailer and be safe. And so once we can get her vision on that, that's all that counts. And then we can kind of herd her with the rest of the people.
for anyone listening who wonders about putting a wild animal in a harness and ropes and having her run around in front of a crowd and what that might do, can you speak to that in terms of how she's treated, how she seems to respond to this ritual?
Yeah, all live mascots across the country, from War Eagle to Mike the Tiger, they have programs that are tied into PETA and tied into everything else, and they make sure she's trained well. We've got a veterinary staff that's always looking after her. She is the best best kept buffalo in the world. I can guarantee you that. She likes working with us. She has fun with it, especially in her younger years. She really enjoys getting out and running and honestly being a part of the team, which is kind of fun. You can see her get excited and like wag her tail, like a dog. When you come out to see her, she loves to come up and say hi to you. The problem with young Ralphies is that they want to play. So she'll play with you with her head and her horns, not knowing her own strength. So certainly keeping her in the best top physical form to go do what she does and keep her safe is our priority. I think the misconception I think a lot of people see from the outside, when she runs to a trailer, we do a big loop and then about 100 yards back into a trailer. People think we're dead-ending her into a wall and like just running her into a trailer and hoping she hits the other side, right? That's not the case. She actually will turn around and look at us before we can slam the door, which is a very fast process. So all her weight is in her front quarter of her body, big head, big shoulders, little tiny butt. So when she decides to hit the brakes, she can turn around literally on a dime and be running the other way faster than humans really can. So that's the biggest misconception. People think we're like bonking her into a wall in there, but she's actually turning around and coming out towards us faster than we can handle.
If you can stereotype or at least characterize the typical Ralphie handler, there are men and women who do this. What is it that makes them tick and makes them want to do this?
We aim for a diverse team. We've had people that had military backgrounds that had served, that had come out. We've got kids that are a computer science major that have never been around livestock. Our goal, and we have farm kids, and we've got people from the inner city. It doesn't matter. We're looking for that well-rounded team so that we can learn from each other as well. I think the piece that makes those diverse minds tick, is a desire to perform. We get a lot of former athletes who, for one reason or another, didn't make the baseball squad or love CU or, just didn't have the right genetic gift to play basketball or football or something. And they want to compete. And they want to do something fun. They want adventure. That's the piece everyone shares. So that one common thread is that like desire for something bigger and desire to be adventurous and do this, right? That's not a normal person. You just don't walk down the street and say like, hey, hold this rope and then see what happens, right? You got to find that right mentality who wants that adventure. It's a fun part to watch her run. A lot gets baked into that. That's not just like a showpiece, right? She is really a part of the team. She's kind of the team captain for us in a lot of ways. And we take and listen to her. And I think, I talked a little bit on this podcast about like learning from your coworkers, learning from people, and she has a lot to offer the Ralphie team. And that to me was the piece that was really interesting, right? Like learning patience, learning how to interact, learning trust, and how to do that with an animal that, most people look at and just think is a savage, horned, sprinting, stampeding beast. But that's not the case, right? It takes a lot of trust between both parties to be able to execute that run. And that isn't earned lightly. That goes through a lot of trials and tribulations, right? And that's something you apply to your marriage, to your business life, to your raising kids, whatever. And I think that's a unique piece about Ralphie that gets overlooked is that trust, that bond that's developed between us and her and the 50,000 people, 54,000 people in Folsom Field. Don't short me, Chris. There's 4,000 you're missing there.
Now, Sean reminded me that Ralphie's location is kept secret by CU. She lives in a ranch. The address is never published so that fans and foes don't know where to find her and she can live peacefully. To take us home in this episode, a very old friend of mine with some great stories to tell. I met John Ruth in the 80s when he was the man inside the Sebastian the Ibis costume at Miami, the bad boy mascot of college football. Now, John was a student at South Carolina, was hired professionally to be the mascot for baseball and football at U of M. That's very rare. Went on to the Florida Marlins. He'll tell a story about a near-death experience before a Sugar Bowl that's scary. But we begin with a funny one. the 89 Miami at Florida State game. Seminoles had that great tradition when Chief Osceola has a flaming spear, goes out to the center of the field aboard Renegade and plants it in the field. So John and some buddies sat around in Miami, had a few drinks, and came up with a crazy idea. Sebastian would wear a firefighter's costume, bring a fire extinguisher to the field, and maybe mess with that great tradition. It did not go well that night in Tallahassee.
So as the game's starting, I've got the fireman's hat, the fireman's jacket, and I've got a fire extinguisher. And I actually was standing there for 2 or 3 minutes before the team came around. And Coach Erickson and the team come around, and I really hadn't figured out exactly what I was going to do yet. I was still standing there going, okay, you know, figured I'd squirt the Miami fans, you know, and I'd squirt near Renegade and Osceola, but I knew I wouldn't get out of Tallahassee alive if I put the spear out, but it was just kind of that, okay, y'all got your flaming spear and we're going to put it out, you know, that kind of a joke to the rivalry. But as Coach Erickson and the team come around and the guy from the TV says, all right, coach, 5 seconds, let's go. And boom, I take the first step and someone grabs me and whips me around. And it's this young face right in, you know, up in the face of the Ibis. And I'm thinking it's the students who opened the gate. And he's yelling, give me the fire extinguisher. Give me the effing fire extinguisher. You know, he's going crazy. And I'm yelling no. Of course, nobody can hear me because the Miami band's playing as the team is going out. But I jerk away from him, and as I jerked away, I squeezed the trigger accidentally and sprayed water all over the chest of a Leon County Sheriff's deputy. Oh, no. So I got maybe another step or two before there were five of them now, and they had slammed me up against the fence. There's a wonderful picture that the Miami Herald photographer took. He just snapped real quick. It's the only known photo of it. There's no video of it. But you know, nowadays, there'd be 5,000 people who had their cell phones out. But they got me up against the fence, one wing to one side, one wing behind my back. And one guy had the beak and was trying to pull it off. And so there, it's now, you know, the team is out there, but now the Miami fans are noticing what's going on. And cups of ice started coming down. And I mean, one of the guys had his handcuffs out and was yelling, I'm going to take you to jail, you know, and it was getting really bad. I mean, literally, can you imagine a guy in a bird costume being carried out in handcuffs? But our cheerleader advisor walked over and said, excuse me, gentlemen, what are you doing to our bird? And I think that kind of hit him that, yeah, okay, wait a minute, let's calm this down. So they poured out the fire extinguisher. They literally, one guy had his hand on my chest, held me against the fence until Chief Osceola went and did the flaming spear thing. And to this day, when Sebastian the Ibis, when Miami goes to play in Tallahassee, someone from Leon's County Sheriff's deputy will find Sebastian the Ibis prior to the game and keep him off the field until Osceola does his little flaming spear. I guess that's the tradition I started with.
But you had no intention of charging out to center of the football field in a bird costume and dousing the flame after you've been thrown on the ground, right?
No, I mean, I really had not even thought it that far. I really just thought, okay, well, you know, we'll have the fire extinguisher. But I would not have gone out in the middle of the field. But I've literally had people who tell me, man, I was in Tallahassee when you grabbed that spear and you broke it over your knee and squirted it down. And then the cops grabbed you. And I'm like, nope, the cops grabbed me before I ever got out on the field. So, just another one of those things. And of course, I mean, Sebastian has a history of doing things with fire extinguishers. You know, obviously we do the smoke, but there were a few other instances where some fire extinguishers got involved.
Any other stories from a career of being one of the bad boys of college football?
Well, you know, that's to say, we didn't think we were when it first started. As Sebastian, I started, and my first game was Jimmy Johnson's first game in 1984. I had been brought down to Miami to work as the baseball mascot, the Miami Maniac, and had worked a couple of years. So Coach Snellenberger left, and it kind of seemed like a great fit. You got me on salary. Let's make him do the football games as well. And so my first game with Coach Johnson, we're actually up in the Meadowlands and for the kickoff classic. We're playing number one Auburn, and I didn't have a place to change. So I knew the equipment guy and I just said, can I change somewhere in the locker rooms? He said, yeah. So I'm sitting there and I didn't know what the schedule was, when the team was going to go out. And I got kind of stuck in the back corner as the team came in, and I'm sitting there and, you know, tights and fur and the head sitting there, and Coach Johnson walking around, he's slapping guys on the helmet. Come on, God, you know, he's motivating everybody. And suddenly he comes to me and he goes, who are you? And I go, hey, Coach, I'm John Ruth. I'm your mascot. He goes, the mascot changes in the locker room? And I went, yeah, Coach, it's a tradition at Miami. Well, I started the tradition right then and there.
I love it.
So he let me stay. And that was one of the things that kind of helped over the 9 years of me being Sebastian the Ibis, was that I was dressing in the locker room. I was part of the team. And I really got to know the guys. And so that helped as things evolved over the years. And you know, your football mascots are a lot tougher than the baseball mascots. As the maniac, I was kind of a lovable loser, but Sebastian had to be tough. And it was an amazing time to be a Miami Hurricane, and I was so fortunate to you know, be the mascot. There was a newspaper article in the early 90s that was talking about how we were the bad boys. We had some amazing guys. We had some great guys. You know, we weren't as bad as people thought. But there was one article that came out and it said, Sebastian the Ibis is the baddest of the bad. And it wasn't that I was trying to be bad. It was just, I looked at my job as upholding the traditions. And one of those traditions was just being as tough as the football team.
Mascots back in the day versus now, John, how much more or how much less latitude do they have? How much more scrutiny is there? How do you think the job has changed to current times now?
Well, I mean, back when I was doing it, there were no rules. So we made up the rules as we went along. You know, if we did something and we had to apologize, which happened quite often, we'd apologize. And so, you know, over the years, there have been a few instances where things have happened. And so now there are some rules and, you know, the characters are a lot less free to just go out and do things. So some of the mascots are trying to do things that you know, get a little more exposure and a little more attention. But yeah, the rules are a lot different now. And you know, we just kind of made them up.
Well, I don't know about the rules the day that Cosmo the Cougar jumped on the set when College Game Day visited BYU. You're singling him out as the guy that's doing it. I looked over my right shoulder. Desmond Howard sits to my right. Cosmo climbed up the scaffolding to the game day set. I said, what the hell? What is he doing? He gets down. I think, oh, we're fine. It's all good. Then he climbs back up a second time, jumps the railing, comes around behind Desmond, behind me, and between myself and Corso, jumps up on the little table that I have. The entire show is on that table. Cards, notes, shot sheets, jumps on the table, kicks the stuff on the floor, knocks my cup of coffee over onto the show, knocks my phone on the floor, grabs a piece of paper that I need for the show, rips it in half. And I'm trying to play off, hey, Cosmo, hey, buddy, jumps down. And finally, I couldn't resist this. If it's okay with Cosmo, go on with the show. We weren't talking about BYU at all in that segment. Johnny, he jumped down. I was told, we didn't insist on it. He got fired on the spot from his role as Cosmo the Cougar. I don't know if they kicked him out of school, but that was serious business. That's funny you bring up Cosmo. That was the most disruptive episode we ever had with a mascot.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's the same one, but the one who's done the dances has done pretty good. But yeah, I mean, and that's what mascots got to be careful. You know, you can go a little too far. You know, we, like I said, we always kind of pushed it to the line, but there are many times where, you know, you can go too far. And that was always, you know.
Well, you left just before game day went on the road. I'll bet you, had you still been Sebastian and College Game Day comes outside the old Orange Bowl in that parking lot, surrounded by people who were preparing for the game, I bet you you'd have been disruptive, man.
We'd have had some fun, I'm sure of that.
What do people not understand about the art of being a mascot, the challenges, everything that goes into it underneath the suit that folks see on Saturday afternoons?
Well, obviously the first thing is you're sweating like crazy. You know, you lose between 8 and 10, 12 pounds a game. The worst game I ever did was we played Florida in 1987, early September, noon game. Mm. And I think I lost 17 and a half pounds. And at the time, I weighed about
Weighed
about 140 pounds. I was down to almost 120 pounds at the end of the game. I got heat stroke, spent 3 days in bed. And actually at the end of the third quarter, I stopped sweating and happened to be in the went to the locker room to take a break. And the paramedic looked at me. There was always one in, you know, outside our locker room. And he looked at me and says, "You look bad." And I said, "Well, I'm not sweating." He goes, "We put some fluid." So they put two IVs in me for about 10 minutes. I emptied the bottles quickly. I went back out because we were playing the Gators and we were beating them. And so I went back out, finished the game. But then I realized I had heat stroke and spent 3 days in bed with like 103 degree fever.
From your experience mentoring mascots, talking to other guys who did the job, is it a case of an alter ego? Is the real person far different from the character in the costume very often?
Most mascots, yeah, there's kind of a little Jekyll and Hyde type thing. I always felt that. My family probably said no, but, you know, I always felt like I would do a lot crazier things in the costume. I mean, the physical things. I'm not a very physical person outside of the costume, but, you know, getting me in the costume and I mean, just some of the crazy things, you know, climbing up stands, letting the crowd pass you up stands. And, you know, I had more knee surgeries and I had a bigger file in the training room than some of the football players.
You had plenty of injuries as Sebastian. You got consistently hurt.
I missed a couple of games. Most of it was late in my career, but I blew out my knee at BYU, and another game, we were a home game. I went up and Arizona missed a field goal that would have won the game at the end of the game. This was, I believe, in 91. And Ryan McNeil, our All-American defensive back, you know, was the guy at the back when the field goal missed. And reached up and high-fived each other, you know, jumping high five at the goal line. Unfortunately, his body kind of pushed me back and I landed awkward and ripped a meniscus in my knee. So there I had six surgeries total in my career, four of them while I was at UM. So there was, it's a good thing we had a wonderful doctor who liked me and said, "Hey, come on in, we'll take care of you."
There was one other time when John needed medical attention on the job. It was the night before the Sugar Bowl down in New Orleans at the end of the 92 season. Miami was set to collide with Alabama for the national championship. It was going to be John's last game in the Sebastian costume.
So as we were walking the first block of Bourbon Street, just off a canal, we're walking and I just felt something. Bam! I was at the back of the group. So most of our group was in front of me. And so there were only a couple of people with me and I just felt something hit me. And I, you know, kind of bent over as if I thought it was a rock, maybe a bottle. And I just kind of bent over. I didn't go down. I, you know, bent over. And about 15 feet away were some police officers on the corner there. And one of them saw me and came over and goes, "Hey guys, we got our first one." And I said, "First one what?" He says, "Gunshot victim." I went, "What?" And blood, of course, was now coming out of my face. We walk over, there was a Woolworths department store right there, and there was a mirror in the window, or the window itself, I guess, was more of a mirror. And he held a towel against me, and he pulled it away, and he goes, "Look, entrance wound, exit wound." And I went, whoa, slow down, do that again. And he goes, "Entrance wound, exit wound."
And he's pointing to your temple and your cheek, right?
Yeah, the bullet, I had just turned my head. We were doing the fight song with those little New Year's Eve horns, you know, da, 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 da. And I had just turned my head, and the bullet entered right next to my eyebrow, went under the skin, hugged the bone, and then exited right here on the middle of my cheek, then grazed my shoulder. I still have the jacket that had a powder burn, and my shoulder actually had it almost entered my chest the second time. So we go to the hospital, they stitch me up. I think it was a total of 11 stitches, 5 on the top, 6 on the cheek. So the next night is the national championship game. And so prior to the game, I've got this little bandage on my face and I'm walking around the sidelines.
But you're in costume now. Now you're in the Sebastian costume.
No, I'm actually out of costume. This is okay. Prior to it. I like to kind of check out the stadium, where are the exits, how can I, you know, take a break and things like that. So I'm walking around and the game was on ABC and Bob Greasy was doing the game. I got to know Bob when he started his broadcasting career. He did some University of Miami baseball games. So Bob and I start talking, and I'm telling him the story, and other reporters started gathering around, and the reporter, I believe it was from the AP, walks up and, you know, is listening to the story, and he goes, "Well, you're not going to work tonight's game, are you?" And I said, "It's going to take a hell of a lot more than a bullet hole to the head to keep me out of this game." My mother had always said I was the luckiest person on earth, and literally the doctor said I was the luckiest person on earth, that it, you know, could have taken just millimeters away, could have taken out the nerves in my face and paralyzed me, or, you know, so I kind of looked at it as God was looking out for me there. And, you know, I just kind of took it as another example of enjoy every day.
Isn't that a perfect message to end on? Enjoy every day. Count our blessings, be grateful for all the things that we have, including the things we love about college football that we didn't have a year ago. I hope this has got you pumped up for the season ahead. I know that I certainly am. My thanks to all my guests. Thanks to the sports information departments at Ole Miss, Washington, and Colorado, and the band directors, Chris Hoke at Ohio State and Donovan Wells at Bethune-Cookman. Thanks to Jason Weichel for his editing skills. And most importantly, thanks to my co-executive producer, Jennifer Dempster. We are certainly excited about the episodes to come in season 3. Invite you to subscribe, rate, and review. And in the meantime, enjoy all of your college football Saturdays.